You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
تشکر میکنم من با استفاده از فرصت ممنون هستم از مردم افغانستان.
Afghanistan holds its first televised political debate. We'll discuss media, military and stability across the region with Rus's Raffaello Pantucci and defense editor Robert Fox. Then we'll get the news from our correspondent Natalie Savarakis in Athens, hear from author Cheryl Tippins about her new book on the Chelsea Hotel, and review some films to boot.
Mr. Theodore Twombly, welcome to the world's first artificially intelligent operating system. We'd like to ask you a few questions.
Okay.
Are you social or antisocial?
I guess I haven't been social in a while.
That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So plenty coming up in the next hour, but before any of that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
The opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics is taking place in the Russian city of Sochi. Almost 3,000 athletes have filed into the stadium ahead of 2 weeks' competition. It's the most expensive Winter Games ever staged, but preparations have been overshadowed by questions about human rights and Russia's controversial laws on homosexuality. Thomas Bach, the president of the International Olympic Committee, says the Games stand for equality.
We are responsible for the Olympic Games and the participants in the Olympic Games. And there it is also very clear that we are standing against any form of discrimination whatsoever, be it of race, gender, sexual orientation. And our responsibility is to have the Olympic Charter being applied.
John Dempsey has travelled from the U.S. state of Virginia to be at the opening ceremony.
Definitely very excited. I've been looking forward to this for a whole year since we started booking everything, so we're excited to be here and part of the Olympic Games.
Anti-government protests in Bosnia have entered a third day and become far more violent. Demonstrators have set fire to government buildings. Police used rubber bullets and tear gas in response. There's been trouble in the capital, Sarajevo, and in the town of Tuzla. The protests centre on the poor state of Bosnia's economy. Around 40% of the population is unemployed. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has condemned comments made by a senior US official about the European Union. Victoria Nuland swore as she complained about the EU's handling of the crisis in Ukraine. A recording of her comments was posted online. Ms. Nuland has travelled to Kiev for talks on the crisis. She's apologised privately to EU officials. EU Commission spokeswoman Pia Arenkilde says the row is distracting attention from a far more important issue.
We are and will remain fully engaged with all our international partners, coordinating our efforts and organisations also which are interested in a political and peaceful solution to the current crisis.
The first civilians have been evacuated from the besieged Syrian city of Homs. It's thought up to 3,000 are in the old city, surrounded by government forces. A UN-negotiated ceasefire means aid should reach them on Saturday. The temporary halt to the fighting follows last month's talks on the civil war in Geneva. Syria's government has confirmed it will attend the second round of negotiations next week. A medical charity says Muslims living in the Central African Republic are facing intolerable levels of violence. They're being targeted for revenge attacks almost a year after Muslim rebels seized power in the country. Médecins Sans Frontières says that thousands have fled to Chad or Cameroon. African Union and French troops are trying to stop violence between Muslim and Christian groups. South Africa's president Jacob Zuma has confirmed a general election will be staged in the country on the 7th of May. His ANC party is expected to win, though it faces growing anger over the failure to lift millions of people out of poverty. For the last month, people living in many townships have been blockading roads and setting cars on fire.
We're going to march, we're going to demonstrate until Tandimu, our premier, come here with respect and resolve our matters.
At the end of the day, we must go and vote for Zuma. No more Zuma, at least.
A Turkish newspaper says one of its journalists has been ordered to leave the country for criticizing the prime minister. Zaman says its online editor was taken by police onto a plane heading for his home country of Azerbaijan. The paper is close to a US-based preacher who is currently leading protests against the prime minister Tayyip Erdogan. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's currently 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. I'm joined now by my two guests to give us their take on the day's news and some of the headlines that have come about this week. Raffaello Pantucci is Senior Research Fellow in Counterterrorism at the Royal United Services Institute, and Robert Fox is Defence Editor for London's Evening Standard. And they're both regulars, of course, here on the show. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start straight off in Afghanistan. The presidential elections are but 2 months away, and campaigning by the 11 candidates is also underway. It will be the third election since the fall of the Taliban and the first transition of power from Hamid Karzai, who is constitutionally bound to step down. As a sign of some progress, perhaps, this week the first ever televised presidential debate took place on Afghan TV. Robert, when you look at what's happening, all these fresh candidates coming up, are these really their own men, or do we think this is kind of a bit of manoeuvring in the background to have a yes man who will kind of continue more of the same, what Hamid Karzai wants? What's your kind of read about what's going on?
Fresh candidates with some pretty old faces.
Yes, well, some of them I see. Yeah, I mean,
when you have Ashraf Ghani, who's been seems to have been around for nearly ever, but he is supported by Abdul Rashid Dostum, who has been around forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, he goes back to the Soviet era, yes. I think you're quite right to put your finger on Karzai. Where does the Karzai patronage go? But I think probably we in the West are probably over-betting on the Karzai patronage. I mean, there has been deep corruption in and around him and close to his family, and he is much resented. And you say, okay, they're trying to put a new face on, there's been a television debate of this, and it's going to be open and transparent. And by the way, unlike the previous three, there just isn't the ground forces from the international community to run this election. Mm. And people are just beginning to take on board how dangerous that is. And the bad old ways, Abdullah, two of his senior campaign directors, very much respected, have been murdered in Herat just as the campaign kicks off. So it's something a little bit new, but it's there's a lot of bad old stuff in this.
Certainly, as you shuffle their CVs, the words that you see popping out are former member of the Mujahideen, mm-hmm. Anti-Soviet resistance fighter. Here's a gentleman who's nicknamed the Bulldozer, a colourful character, apparently.
No, that's Dostum.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Raffaello, again, when you look at these candidates, is it just going to be more of the same? Is there a fear that we could break out into kind of more tribalism? Because Hamid Karzai, in a way, there has been that element, but he's somehow kind of kept that side of Afghanistan kind of together. What's your reading on where we're headed over the next couple of months?
I think you put your finger on something very important there, which is this risk of a sort of return to the warlordism of the past. I think what Robert was saying about how a lot of these figures are very similar, and it's very much the cast of characters that we've seen before. We haven't really got any fresh, new, young candidates. I mean, I don't think any of the parties that they're speaking about are particularly new either. These are names that have been rattling around for a very long time in sort of Afghanistan recent history, right back to the days of the Soviet Mujahideen. But I think what's worrying in some ways is that if these big sort of individuals, at least they're kind of engaging in a process at the moment. I suppose the risk is if they don't and they decide to just retreat back to their old ways of being warlords, that they might just decide to take over a section of the country again, rearm their sort of individual militias, and just you return to the sort of Afghanistan of the past, which is essentially a sort of fiefdom ruled over different sections of it, ruled over by different warlords. And I know certainly when I was there about mid last year, this was one of the major concerns. And this was, you could see this in the north happening a bit already, with Dostum and Fahim sort of seeming to rearm some of their people. And there's a whole question about, was this a case of the north was sort of starting to harden off, and then what was going to happen, and was it going to return to the fact that the president would end up being a sort of mayor of Kabul while the rest of the country divided up as, you know, as whoever was the strongest sort of security actor on the ground. It's difficult to know whether the election and the which of these leaders would be the sort of figure who would be a sort of unifying figure who would be able to look beyond these. I think more what will be the interesting questions over the next few weeks really is how we see the sort of political winds shifting and how we see people brokering deals for different ministries and different positions within the administration, and who the consensus is, who is going to be the leader. And then this sort of some of these big fish who maybe don't get the top job but get an important ministry to keep them sort of involved in the process. I think that's really where the sort of interesting deal making will come out.
Robert, when you look along that list, is there, if you were sitting in the US State Department, who would you want to put your tick next to on that long list of names?
Well, the trouble is that there's, I think
I'm not saying it works like that.
Can I say that as an Englishman, that tick is probably the wrong and the right expression on this. Who is going to suck the blood from this? As Raphael hinted, we've got to look in, you know, the absolutely endless, almost hideously unbroken patronage system that you get in Afghanistan. And that's why you are right to come back to Karzai, although I disagree with your depiction of him. I think he did play the tribal game, either subtly or unsubtly, particularly through more powerful members of his family, like Ahmed Walid in Kandahar. And I think he is put his dabs are all over this one. I think the interview with Christina Lamb in the Sunday Times was strategically placed. It was a pretty disgraceful affair on the part of Karzai when he was saying that, you know, the international troops shouldn't have come here and the British just brought damage to Helmand, as if Helmand was motherhood and apple pie beforehand. His deep duplicity and corruption of his family is a very big question, and it throws the really big question mark over the whole enterprise. Really, having to deal with such clients, why on earth did America rush into the business and their John the Baptist, if I can use it, of their cause in nation building in Afghanistan was one Tony Blair. But they undertook an enterprise of nation building in a very, very difficult and critical situation. I'm talking about the end of 2001, which they didn't even have the intellectual means, let alone the physical and the hard power means to carry out. Some people are now getting really serious about it. Even, you know, people like Joe Biden have been discussing, actually, if you were going to do this properly, you'd have probably needed 500,000 troops to do it. And I've always, for as long as I've worked in Afghanistan, heard the 500,000 troop figure. But it's not wrong in some ways to suggest that it was absolutely inadequate. And you can see intellectually, even when you get sort of quite big figures like Petraeus going in, actually, they weren't bringing the resources to the problem that were really really required at the time. And I think that this is the huge problem. And we've talked about whether it can hold together. Actually, there's one big issue, is whether they can have a relatively violence-free election campaign, which, frankly, I doubt, and whether the armed forces, the Afghan National Security Forces, the ANSF, the police and the army, can hold the thing together to a reasonable degree afterwards. And the more I look at it, the more I doubt that too. It's a very fragile thing that we've got there at the moment.
Raphael, in this very fragile kind of world, do you think we will look back and think, actually, well, Ahmed Karzai may be corrupt, may have had a kind of terrible web of businesses, may have done all sorts of things wrong, But as we've seen so often, when we lose somebody we don't particularly like, like Assad or something, then we look back a few years later and think, oh my God, at least he did manage to kind of, you know, have some control over the country. And also, and maybe as you give your reply to that, I often wonder also whether Karzai got a bit of an easier ride in the West, in the press in a way, because he was quite good at playing the Westerner. He could, you know, he looked good in the part.
Oh, come on, he was one of them. He'd been their translator, people like Christina Lamb. That's why he got a good press.
What do you think?
I think that, you know, I think to your point about Karzai, I mean, I think the thing that always surprised me a bit about him was when I went to Afghanistan and spoke to sort of Afghans about him, I was always surprised by, they always had this very great sense of how corrupt he was, but they think all politicians are corrupt, and they probably are, frankly, in some ways. And, you know, and they always had this very negative sense of that sort of thing. But at the same time, there was a perception that he was something of a national leader, and he did have this sort of support behind him. There's a sort of public sense of
I'm bound to agree with you there. Which means that,
you know, he obviously had something going for him. So I think that, you know, we maybe look at it from the perspective of him doing interviews with Christine Lamb and with others, in which he makes these sorts of pronouncements about, you know, like I saw apparently now he's got a list of incidents of operations that have been carried out by the Taliban, which he knows have been carried out by American forces. You know, and so do these sorts of stories make you sit and think, you know, you're like, what the hell is this guy doing? But then on the other hand, I think he does have some sort of public appeal out in Afghanistan, which doesn't really get covered and we don't really hear about. So maybe there's something to your point that he is maybe more of a unifying figure than we're seeing at the moment. The question I would say is, do we have any idea if any of these other people who are rising up or trying to contend to be the presidential candidate now have that sort of appeal? And I don't know that they necessarily do, but then I also don't know if we necessarily would totally know that.
Robert, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, well, he has a surprise, but doesn't seem to have over much faith in him. He's picked his brother, Qaim Karzai, who's but he would only be a figurehead. And somehow there is a feeling that Zalmay Rasool, a former foreign minister, will end up in the mix. But Rafael is absolutely right. Of all the people that I talk to, they're, yes, right on two counts. One, Karzai, despite everything, is seen as a national figure. Two, it is very difficult to see who can take that slot at the moment. We're at a different point from where we were in 2001. And by the way, of the Western Americans, Karzai wasn't the first choice. Abdul Haq was. Yeah. But he's filled the slot. But, and we've talked about, oh, you know, he's really Tajik, but he's got some Pashtun blood. He'd been a foreign minister. Why not Abdullah would lose Pashtunistan. It is very complicated. And then you're getting, as we withdraw, we must talk about this. Thank God that's over. The view from the West, you know, why do we have to talk about Afghanistan? I think Afghanistan, if we take our eye off this, as journalists, as well as politicians, it's going to be a lot more trouble than we would have legislated for. Because the one thing, I'm sorry, I'm a real bore, and I've been a real bore on Midori House and throughout Monocle about this. You cannot get over the core of the economy is the narco economy, and it is stronger than ever. And it has huge ramifications. And that's why Mr. Putin's view and the Chinese leadership's view of it, which we're not factoring in nearly enough, as well as India, Pakistan, Iran, is terribly important. This thing is, it's not only of regional, I suspect it is of global significance.
Well, really great stuff there, gentlemen. Stay with us. We're going to have a short break now and come back to talk about German defence and also US strategies in that region.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print, and that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world, and that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is RUSI Senior Fellow Raffaello Pantucci and Defence Editor Robert Fox. Before the break, we discussed the role of a new Afghan president, what pressures he will face from the international community. America is a country with a lot invested in the region, not least because it believes terror networks in both Afghanistan and Pakistan affect US security at home and abroad. The US Treasury Department announced this week that in a bid to stem funding to the group, it has frozen the assets of three leaders from the Pakistani Taliban-linked Haqqani network. But does this really make any impact? Does it, Robert?
I think it's a very interesting technique. I'm surprised they pulled it out of the hat before, because it actually started and was pioneered very successfully in Sicily in the early 1980s, when there was the murder of a very respected communist regional councillor, regional president, I think it was, in the end, Latore. Mm-hmm. And the Legislatore has been extremely successful and has been adopted. It is sequestering criminal funds, slush funds, even if they're at times legally gained, of people of known criminal association. The fact that they think that they can get into the Haqqani network in this way, I think, is very interesting. On the one hand, it's bank balances, it's the Balat and the Armalite, as it were, and the other, you're using drones. Why they're doing it, why they're announcing it now, is particularly interesting. And it's because of these talks, which nobody, even the old hands, even the journalists who were involved in the talks, don't hold out much hope for them. The discussion between elements of Pakistan Taliban and the Nawaz Sharif government. I think that they're very, very worried that they want to put salt on the tail of the Haqqani network, which is among the most violent. I don't think it's deeply involved or deeply committed to the talks. What they're worried about with the talks, it seems absolutely clear. I'd be very interested to hear what Rafael says about this. I think that they benefit entirely the Taliban, even if they're unsuccessful, but they undermine Nawaz Sharif, and the Americans are extremely worried about that, that his authority is being atomized, fragmented as this goes on.
Rafaela, tell me, if I was a member of the Haqqani network, would I be popping my cash in the Bank of America, though?
Probably not, but, you know, then there's this doesn't just define it for American banks. It's a sort of bigger picture than that. It means you can't do business in a whole raft of places and other people can't do business with you. And anyone who wants to have an interest in the United States can't do business with you.
So it's leaning on banks throughout all these.
It's extremely interesting that this is going on because, of course, there has been this row about the IOC, the Vatican Bank, where American partners have been told to get out of it because this is known to be a conduit for laundering money. And they're really putting the brakes on. And it is very much part of a piece. If you're going to be involved in the American banking regime, then you must not be touched by this. I think it's wise, it's cautionary, it's very clever propaganda. But back to the previous thing about Karzai, I think it's also related to that. Because one of the things that Karzai thinks he's been terribly clever about, and I think he hasn't, is not signing the bilateral security agreement, the BSA, with the Americans. And Biden and others have been saying, this can only go on so long, and we're going to do it another way. If you don't want our 12,000 to 14,000 international troops, we're going to do other things by other means. And this is the kind of thing that they're flagging up.
Now, I don't want to miss out on a kind of a juicier topic to get into at the end of the show, which is Angela Merkel. Germany, interestingly, is one of the nations that said that actually after the pulling out of most troops, its troops will stay. Does this mark a change in temperament, the idea that actually Germany feels that it should be kind of a bit more kind of bullish with both its military and defence policy?
Isn't this a discussion we've been having for quite some time? I mean, this idea of sort of German resurgent military power or a sort of more assertive Germany, this is something I'm pretty sure we've been talking about for many years at this point. The fact that they went into Afghanistan in the first place was a sort of indicator of that. The fact they're involved in the sort of Balkans and supporting some operations there, the fact that they've been involved as... I mean, this is not a particularly new story. I think it's interesting that it seems to be getting more wind now, and I'll be honest, entirely sure why this is. Because as I say, I'm pretty sure we've heard this before. I think it's interesting in some ways to look at this in comparison to what we see in Asia. And the whole question of Abe trying to sort of reopen Japan maybe as something more of a forthright military power. And I think seeing these two in sort of comparison is an interesting sort of, case study in some ways.
Robert?
I think there is an occasion. I think there is a point, sorry to take you up on this. Mm. Yes, we've had the very glamorous face of armed peacekeeping with Dr. Ursula von der Leyen. In this, a remarkable figure to be put in as defence minister in this new government by Angela Merkel. You would think that, you know, it could be the one not putting her protege in, but waiting for her protege or the pretender to her throne to screw up, because she's been in social affairs, she's a medical doctor, seven children, why is she doing it? And I tell you, I think there is some real method, and I think Angela really does trust her, and it's this, that Germany... Berlin is very worried about the cozying up between UK and France, whatever the difference is, because there was a very strong reaction to this cooperation on drones. Are we allowed to call them drones? The Brits and the French hate killing them. But this is rather strange meeting that happened in Oxford. But it's no doubt about it. The French and the Brits are leading on their medium-level drone. It is not the so-called male. Park that. And they've said to Germany very carefully, you can come in if you feel like it, but not right now. We're not sharing our secrets with you. The other thing in European common foreign policy and defence policy, the Berlin-Paris axis has all but collapsed. Mm. Do you remember the Franco-German military corps, the two battalions, French? It's had to be disbanded. Mm. And Merkel is very, very shopkeeperish about this, because one of the things she really does want to defend is Germany's place in aerospace and in the defence industry in that order. And she sees EADS, now partly renamed Airbus, as primarily a German business. That's why it was she and nobody else that kept BAE out when British Aerospace formally... proposed a merger. Mm. Now, according to all the sense, all the statistics, the size of market, the narrowing domestic base, there will be, and I will predict for you, there will be at the maximum 18 months, and certainly I would think, almost certainly in calendar year 2014, there will be a merger, an alliance, a marriage, a partnership between EADS and BAE. But this is what's going on with this posturing, because when you see what she is doing with these troops, it's barely barely above the armed Boy Scouts level.
We're almost out of the show. Yeah. I wanted to get Raphael or one of you to comment on a slightly different story that has obviously made the news today. This is Victoria Nuland, the US official, who's had to apologise for comments. Did she or didn't she make them? We think she probably did. Mm-hmm. Describing the
EU.
Was
she good on YouTube saying them?
Yes.
Was it quite fruity terms.
Did the Russians take it? It begins with an F and something the EU. Yeah. I think the T-shirt's being printed in Brussels as we speak. But what do we think this says about... Is there anything wider this says about the relationship between the US and the EU's foreign policy?
Yes, is the answer.
Yes, I think it clearly does. I think we've seen a sort of frosting, frankly, in the EU-US relationship in a very long time, and this is just the sort of latest expression of it. Obama has made it abundantly clear since he's been in power that he doesn't see the transatlantic relationship as something he's going to prioritise, and here we can see one of his top diplomats saying just as much, you know?
And they want the EU to do the heavy lifting, because they still see America's position, and you talked, they're very worried about the Pacific and the Gulf and further east. Mm. They still stick to the mantra of full spectrum dominance. and the people who have a certain amount of sophistication who should be helping are the Europeans, and we're wimps.
Well, that's the way to end a week, a great week of Midori House. Thank you, gentlemen. That was, of course, Raffaello Pantucci and Robert Fox. And thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty is still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with our correspondent in Athens, and author Cheryl Tippins attempts to define the history of the Chelsea Hotel in New York. But before we get started on that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest world news headlines.
Anti-government protests in Bosnia have turned increasingly violent on their third day. Demonstrators set fire to government buildings. Police responded with rubber bullets and tear gas. There's been trouble in the capital, Sarajevo, and in the town of Tuzla. The opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics is drawing to a close in the Russian city of Sochi. Almost 3,000 athletes have filed into the stadium. The torch will soon be lit at the beginning of 2 weeks of competition. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has condemned comments made by a senior US official about the European Union. Victoria Nuland swore as she complained about the EU's handling of the crisis in Ukraine. A recording of her comments was posted online. She's apologised privately to EU officials. The first civilians have been evacuated from the besieged Syrian city of Homs. It's thought up to 3,000 are in the old city, which is surrounded by government forces. A UN-negotiated ceasefire means aid should reach them on Saturday. And South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, has confirmed that a general election will be staged in the country on the 7th of May. His ANC party is expected to win, though it faces growing anger over the failure to lift millions of people out of poverty. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul, and welcome back to Midori House. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Athens, where our correspondent, Natalie Savarakis, awaits us. Natalie, thank you very much for coming on the show. Let's start, first of all, with some of these incessant earthquakes that are happening.
Yes, it's pretty impressive, actually. On the western island of Kefalonia, which is in the Ionian, for the past 10 days, the island has been rattled constantly, whether by two big earthquakes around 6 on the Richter scale, or just constantly by aftershocks. Tremors have been rattling the island, and it has caused very serious damage to buildings, cracked roads. Luckily, though, no one was seriously injured.
And how common are these quakes?
Well, Greece is, if you like, a seismogenic zone. So we are hit with many tremors quite often, and most of them are, of course, don't cause any serious damage. Kefalonia itself, the island, was hit with a very serious earthquake some 60 years ago, which completely devastated the island. And so since, it has been built in a way which essentially makes the entire island more earthquake-proof, if you like, and has helped the island survive these two very important quakes.
And is there any fear that, you know, the important income that comes into the island during the tourist trade, that the island won't be ready come summer?
Well, that is what the tour operators here have been trying to prepare themselves. First of all, the authorities have immediately sent out all the necessary equipment to start rebuilding all the damage that was caused. And of course, the tour operators themselves are trying to send out warnings and to potential visitors that the island will indeed be ready for the summer season, because it is one of the most popular destinations in Greece. And of course, tourism in Greece represents a fifth of the income of the country.
Now, a story that you've helped us cover in great detail over the past few months is the story of Golden Dawn, which has obviously been made illegal in Greece. But the party or its former members have said that one way or the other, they will stand in May elections, which is for both local and European elections.
Indeed. Well, what Golden Dawn is fearing after many of its MPs now, including its leader, are behind bars on charges of forming and running a criminal organization, and even state funding has been suspended. So they're fearing that the authorities here are trying to ban the party altogether and prevent them from running in the local, as you mentioned, European elections this May. So in order to avoid that, they've created a sister party called the National Dawn. This was announced last weekend by the party spokesman Elias Kassidiaris at a big crowd in the center of Athens. And they said that whatever happens, they will try to run one way or the other, because they call this a crackdown by the government, basically a political persecution, they say, because of their ideology and that it's not based on any conclusive evidence.
And finally, an unusual photography exhibition that's taking place in Athens.
Yes, it's called Contre-Plongée. It's actually even organized by a choreographer, not even a photographer. And what she did was she gave disposable photo cameras to homeless people because she was struck, she said, 2 years ago when she saw this old lady, which was impeccably dressed, just standing under the rain for days. And she asked her what she was doing, and she said she was a homeless, so she decided to give her a camera, a photo camera, and take pictures of things that would represent happiness or her hidden desires. And that developed into a project where she handed out these cameras to various homeless people in Greece. And I remind you, homelessness is a big issue because it's just soared exponentially since the beginning of the crisis. And what we're seeing is pretty melancholic, if you like, photography, blurry pictures or pictures where you have a thumb in front or a camera, really, but they convey really this feeling of loneliness and desire, whether it is for a dish of pasta, a frozen yogurt, a dog, a pigeon, or even a church. And this is really what we see here is the hidden world of the homeless people and their frustrations, their desires, and their loneliness overall.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Natalie. Great as ever to check in with you, and have a great weekend. That was, of course, Natalie Savarakos, who's our correspondent in Athens. Up next, we'll head over to New York and hear from author Cheryl Tippins about her new book, Inside the Dream Palace. Stay tuned.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The Briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, and the time now is 18:38. And it's that time in the show, well, it is Friday, when we talk films. And Alex Godfrey, a journalist and now a friend of Monocle 24, has come in to tell us about some of the films that he's seen that he thinks that we should talk about, at least. We're going to start, Alex, with Her. And this is a film that I guess has been getting a lot of publicity, maybe not as quite as nominations for awards as some thought it even deserved, because it's about our relationship with technology and a rather deep relationship in this case with technology.
Kind of. I mean, that's the scenario, that's the concept and the backdrop. It's about a guy, it's set in the near future. I don't think it specifies when. And it's in LA, and it's about a guy played by Joaquin Phoenix who falls in love with an extremely intelligent artificial intelligent operating system. But it's kind of a red herring because it's really Spike Jonze's exploration of relationships and loneliness and how people connect. And, you know, she's such a fully formed woman, this operating system, that you buy it straight away as a relationship movie. It's not really techie. It's not like Tron or something.
But when I mentioned the idea of technology, you say not really. But isn't it heightened by the fact that, you know, in life today, our technology does kind of alienate us from other people? We talk to our phone. We're with our phone. That is often, for many people, it seems to be the most important relationship they have, when you see them sitting in a restaurant caressing their phone but ignoring their girlfriend.
Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. And I think from what I've gathered, and I spoke to Spike Jonze, and I think that was the starting point for it. I think, but he came up with it before Siri came out, but there was something similar that he was interacting with some sort of computer, and he thought, this is interesting. But I don't think the film is an explicit comment about it. It's more of an observation. It's something to chew on, but it's not sort of a social statement, as it were.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
Mr. Theodore Twombly, welcome to the world's first artificially intelligent operating system. We'd like to ask you a few questions.
Okay.
Are you social or antisocial?
I guess I haven't been social in a while.
How would you describe your relationship with your mother? Thank you. Please wait as your operating system is initiated.
Hello, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Samantha.
So Samantha is obviously the operating system he kind of falls in love with. And tell me, Alex, you know, is it difficult for a film goer or an actor to have a role where you're there with a screen as your on-screen partner, as it were?
I think it was difficult for Joaquin Phoenix because he's kind of acting for both. I mean, Scarlett Johansson is incredible in it. I mean, you believe straight away. But do you know what I mean? It's not what I was saying before about the technology being a bit of a red herring. It's like he's having a relationship with a woman who you just can't see. She's like an invisible woman because she is so fully formed and so complete as a person and as a personality. It's sort of besides the point. But he has to do a lot of work because you gauge what's going on with their relationship by the way he's reacting to it. So,
and as far as I know, he didn't get nominated for Best Actor, did he? He kind of missed out on some of the nominations in the series of kind of film awards we've had.
He was Golden Globe nominated.
Okay.
He didn't win. There's only five, and that stuff's all nonsense anyway. He's brilliant in it. It's just ridiculous.
You can always rely on Alex to disagree with you. It's good. Next, let's move on. Only Lovers Left Alive. This is Jim Jarmusch. A return, everyone, well, probably Alex is going to tell me I'm wrong here. A return to form, everyone says, but you probably say his form has never gone away.
Am I that contrary?
Don't worry, we'll talk about it afterwards.
No, I think his last couple of films before this have been horrendous. I love him when he's good. And, you know, a lot of his films are great. And this, to me, definitely is one of them. It reminded me a lot of Dead Man, which is one of my favourite films of his. It's absolutely unique. It's Jim Jarmusch through and through. Return to form, I think, is a funny phrase.
But that can go in the poster.
Yeah, with your name on it. But it's if you like Jim Jarmusch, you'll absolutely love it. It's a beautiful, beautiful, really...
Well, I like Tilda Swinton.
Oh, do you know what? This part was just made for her. She fits it like a glove. She's just like this ethereal alien being in it. I mean, they are actually vampires in the film.
Okay, let's that, we'll come on to that in a second. But let's have a clip, first of all.
1868, her third wedding. It looks so young.
Give my regards to that suicidally romantic scoundrel.
Well, let's hope he's just romantic.
You being so reclusive in everything is probably only going to make people more interested in your music.
Yeah, what a drag.
Alex, any sense, you mentioned there the vampire element, any sense of him being a bit late to the vampire party?
No, because it's Jim Jarmusch, and I think anyone who sees a film with his name on the top of it is going to know that it's not going to be Twilight. It's, you know, and again, I hate to repeat myself, but in terms of what we were talking about with the technology on her, the vampires are kind of a red herring. It's not a genre film. It's not about bloodsuckers going around killing people. It's not very dramatic. Not a lot happens. He's made them vampires so that they can have been alive for a few hundred years, and Jim Jarmusch can then use that to comment on civilization, culture, and how things have changed, and what they appreciate in life, and sort of where they've come from, and where we've got to as a civilization.
Some of the reviews have hinted that where he is also trying to comment is about drugs and drug dependency a little bit. Do you think that's a strain there?
Kind of. I mean, it's an idea in there, but it's not a film about dependency or addiction. It's really about culture and you know, what it is to be alive.
Okay, now I really can't wait to get your opinion on this. This is we're going to do Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac last, and let's hear a clip first this time before we have a discussion about this.
All I wanted to say was that if you have wings, why not fly?
If I asked you to take my virginity, would that be a problem?
No, I don't see a problem.
You are to ask him if he wants to have sex with me.
Yeah.
My name is Jo.
Hi, Jo.
Hi, Jo.
And I'm a nymphomaniac.
Sex addict.
We say sex addict.
Now, we've all seen the stories that have percolated around this film and popped up in, you know, the tabloids as well, because, you know, there's oral sex, there's every kind of sex you can mention, there's a montage of penises, there's the whole thing. And for a long, long time, those things, you know, banal and stupid though they are, they make the headlines, and they certainly don't help, don't hinder his cause at kind of creating some controversy around what he does, which is always seems to sit there. What do you take of it as a film, though?
Oh, I love it to pieces. And what, in terms of what you were just saying, what Lars is doing this time is great. He's not talking to anyone. He's not doing any press. He's letting the film do all the talking. You know, because after he had his fallout in Cannes a couple of years ago when he made some misjudged comments about being a Nazi, he decided never to speak to the press again. And he, you know, all due respect, he hasn't, and he's not speaking to the press. But the film is very much Lars on a mission. It's him guns blazing. It's a sexual odyssey set over many decades. It pulls no punches, and it kind of feels like everything he's ever done and everything you've ever wanted him to do. And it sort of feels like a swan song, because he's just doing everything. It's really provocative, but not in a juvenile way. It's, you know, there's a lot of intellectual content, and a lot of it is quite farcical as well. It's really intentionally jagged. It's really funny. And there are things that happen in this film. You sit there wincing, thinking, please don't do that. And then they do that.
An amazing lineup, and quite an interesting cast lineup. Well, it seems to me Jamie Bell, Uma Thurman, Christian Slater, William Defoe. Lots of people obviously want to work with him, although he's meant to be quite a brutal director to work for.
Well, I don't need. He's got that reputation for being a brutal director, but people keep coming back to work with him, and everyone who works with him. It was only Bjork really who sort of really fell out with him and ended up eating her clothes or whatever happened there. But you know, people keep coming back time and time again, and they want to work with him because he is so original, and he writes such amazing characters. I mean, the roles he writes, especially for the women, no one else is doing it. I can't imagine a world without him making films, because it's so exciting and so interesting.
Well, that certainly does deserve to go on the poster, I think. So, Alex Godfrey, thank you very much for coming to see us for our film review on the Friday. And we're going to be back with more after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, we're going to have a slight pause for some music, and then we're going to be talking about, a hotel where I think Nymphomaniac could have maybe been filmed. But more of that anon. First of all, we're going to have Lou Reed, because, he used to live in this hotel, and this is his track, Walk on the Wild Side. And how good is that? And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now let's head to New York, a cult institution featured in musical and cinematic works and fabled by self-destructive geniuses. The Chelsea Hotel is known better for its tenants than the quality of its rooms. Ahead of its proposed renovation, one new book hopes to provide the definitive story behind its history. It's called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. And its author, Cheryl Tippins, joins us on the line now from the New York Bureau. Welcome to the show, Cheryl. An amazing book. Let's just start with a very basic question. You know, this is so many people who had passed through that building over such a period of time, many leading chaotic lives with drink and drugs and gosh knows what else involved. Was it incredibly hard to find reliable sources and to pull together all these interviews?
Hi, Andrew. Yes, it was quite a challenge. It was a project I thought would take about a year and a half, and I spent 6 years doing the research for the book, largely because for every story there are 10, 20, 30 variations. So it was difficult to try to decide which one was the closest to the truth. And that's why we call it legendary.
And tell me, just take us back a little way. Explain how this hotel became such a magnet for everyone from, you know, Brendan Behan, as we were saying, to Lou Reed, Sid Vicious, all these people came through that building. Why?
That's what interested me about the building initially. I had heard all of the legends that you mentioned, all the stories about all the people who lived at the Chelsea fairly recently, and was crossing the street one day and looked up at it. It happened that it was a thunderstorm and a huge bolt of lightning flashed above the building and illuminated it in all its Gothic glory. And in that moment, I thought, what is this building doing there? How did it happen? How did it become the Chelsea Hotel? So I started doing some research, and I found out that it had been an artist community from the beginning, when it was built in the 1880s, before artists were even got any respect at all in the United States, in New York. And it was created by a utopian-minded Frenchman named Philip Hubert. His mother was British, actually. And his idea was to try to help jumpstart an indigenous culture in the United States that didn't really exist to any great degree yet. The Americans were still enamored with European art and fashion and decor and so on.
And
so he thought...
Sorry to jump in. I just wanted if you could tell me, when was the kind of the peak of its kind of power? Was it the 60s, do you think? Is that the time when there were the most interesting characters there?
Yeah, I think the most interesting to most people was certainly the 1960s. And when I got to the 60s, there were so many stories, I had to really slow down the pace to include them all. So whereas one chapter might cover 50 years, in another era of the Chelsea, it took, I think, three chapters to cover the 1960s alone. But the 60s never, the point is of the book is that the 60s at the Chelsea never would have happened without the layers of work and gathered stories and community and conversations that had gone through many generations before then. So really, by the time Bob Dylan arrived in 1965, by that time, he was walking into an incredibly rich culture that had already developed there with Thomas Wolfe, Dylan Thomas, of course, with the Beat Poets. All of that had seeped into the walls of the building, in a sense, before Bob Dylan walked in. And then he could take all of this material, this accrued material, and put it into his album Blonde on Blonde.
And Cheryl, tell me, we hinted there that there is some debate over the future of the building and its future use. You know, is it going to be for the kind of the grander people who stay these days in New York, or can it remain an artist community?
Well, it's very interesting. The person who bought the hotel, who owns it now, is a former developer of the Hard Rock Hotel in Las Vegas. So that doesn't bode particularly well for the Chelsea's rebirth as an artist community. But on the other hand, it's physically designed to be one in very specific ways. And the new owner says he does have a lot of respect for its function, and he is going to try to recreate an artistic community there. The question is, can you artificially recreate an artistic community? It'll be very interesting to see.
Well,
if you can.
Cheryl, thank you for taking time to head over to our New York bureau, and I hope you have time to kind of saunter past there for us. It's an amazing book, and we certainly recommend it to everyone. It's called Inside the Dream Palace, and you heard there from author Cheryl Tippins. We'll have many more author stories coming from New York over the following week, but in fact, that's kind of it from this episode of Midori House, and from a full week of Midori House, because I've got to say goodbye. So thanks in particular to our special guests, Raffaello Pantucci and also Robert Fox. Today's show was produced by Ali John, and it was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. James Bullock and Rosie Sells also helped. Our studio manager was, of course, the one and only Chris Chilvers. Next up, we join Marcus Hippie for The Menu, our food and drink show. This week, he'll be assessing the culinary trends at this year's Fancy Food Show in San Francisco. He gets the latest on the Hong Kong food scene with local connoisseurs Josh and Caleb Ng of The Twins Kitchen, and there'll be lots more.
The food scene, you know, is growing like more diverse, and now we are talking about maybe 5 years ago, it's like about only Thai food, but now we got Northern Thai food, we got Southern Thai food. And people are getting more specific with different ingredients, food-wise.
Sounds very tasty. Stick around for that. The show will be back at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time for me to say goodbye and thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.